8th of December 2024, Bashar al-Assad boarded a Russian-bound plane as rebel forces overran Damascus. After 13 years of civil war and 5 decades of brutal rule, the House of al-Assad had come to an inglorious end. The jihadi, now-turned statesman Ahmed al-Sharra, has since faced immense challenges from unifying a fractured Syria, dealing with constant Israeli incursions, and attracting foreign investment. So how is Syria without the al-Assads? Have things improved under the new regime? These are just some of the questions we want to explore today. We will also be publishing a deep dive on the geopolitics of Syria on this one-year anniversary, which you can access from our website. Here to help navigate all these questions is geopolicy founder Adnan Khan. Assalamu alaikum, Adnan. Pray you're well.
Assalam, Imran. Yeah, I'm doing well. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Jazakallah khair. I hope you're keeping warm.
Alhamdulillah.
I want to remind everyone that you can find us on all the major social media platforms where you can subscribe and never miss anything. So Adnan, let's begin our conversation with the events of last year. So Assad's regime withstood 13 years of pressure and conflict, yet it collapsed within a span of 2 weeks or so. So what changed? How do we explain such a rapid shift after so many years of resilience?
So two things really, Imran, internal and external. If we look internally, the Syrian economy was in a state of severe crisis. After 13 years of civil war, poverty was widespread and infrastructure was completely broken, damaged. If you look at manufacturing, production and services, they were in a disastrous state due to 13 years of war. So what this meant was soldiers, militias and even supporters of the regime, they weren't receiving money, they weren't receiving salaries, and all of this led to a lot of corruption. So the security class, who was in constant war for a 13-year period, their economic situation was even dire as well. If we now start looking externally, Iran, who had saved the Syrian regime, Iran, who entered the war effort, committed untold atrocities, what they were doing was actually embedding themselves in Syria. So although Bashar al-Assad welcomed them in, as far as he was concerned, after 13 years of war, Iran had basically outlived its welcome. Then probably I would say the most fundamental thing that changed after 13 years of war was October 7th, what happened in Gaza, what happened in Israel. After October 7th, what Israel wanted was all the proxy groups should be destroyed in the region. So Hezbollah, Hamas, then obviously the Houthis as well. And what Israel did was it managed to convince the Americans that this had to be the case in the region. So where Syria came into this equation was Hezbollah's supply line ran from Iran through Iraq, through Syria into Lebanon. So Israel wanted that supply line gone. And that was where the end of the Syrian regime came into play. So what happened? America, we now know, because this has been revealed by the groups that were involved, the US arranged the proxy groups in the south of Syria and they linked up and coordinated with the groups in the south, so HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. And what we know then was history. They launched strikes from the north and from the south they came to Damascus. And we saw that long march from Aleppo down to Homs, down to Hama and eventually into Damascus. So what that means is Ahmad al-Sharra didn't just come out of nowhere. He's actually been on the radar of the US for a very, very long time. So really, the country was in a dire strait for 13 years of civil war. And then this external factor, this is what fundamentally made the difference.
So how would you describe this situation prior to this, prior to the 13 years?
So prior to the first, so before the Arab Spring kicked off 2011, 2012 in Syria, you effectively had a secret state where you had this family, the al-Assad family who ruled. It was a brutal rule. We now know when the regime fell, the prisons, the slaughter, the torture that was going on. This was a regime that ruled through fear. They had their support base amongst the Alawis in the coastal areas. As far as everyone else was concerned, they lived in the secret state. Everything was monitored. If they believed you were a threat, you disappeared into these secret torture chambers and prisons. And that's why the Arab Spring came to Syria in the end. It came to Syria because the people just had enough living like that. And that's how life was. So, You know, there's an argument that if the uprising didn't happen, there wouldn't have been a brutal crackdown. You know, there wasn't some nirvana the people were living in beforehand. The people lived in a secret state, not that different really to North Korea, where people regularly disappeared, people were regularly tortured, people were regularly oppressed. And that's why it was inevitable that the Arab Spring was going to come to Syria.
Okay. You've touched upon it, but the new figurehead at the center of Syria's political landscape is Ahmed al-Sharaa. Now, before we assess how he's managed power so far, or being in power so far, could you start by giving us some context on his background? You know, what should people know? What should we know about him?
So Ahmed al-Sharaa was formerly known as Abu Muhammad al-Jilani. He is a former member of Al-Qaeda from Iraq, who then came to Syria when the uprising started there. So his original background is really the American occupation of Iraq. And along with Al-Qaeda, they carried out insurgency against American forces and foreign forces. He was then eventually sent to effectively expand Al-Qaeda into Syria when the Arab Spring started. But even prior to him going to Syria, he spent about 5 years in the famous US prison, the Kambaka prison, the south of Baghdad. And this was the prison where all of the ISIS leadership came from eventually, you know, which is really, really suspect. You know, a lot of people have questions about this. So America knew about Ahmed al-Sharaa well before he was a household name. They knew all the ISIS leadership before they became the ISIS leadership, because all of these guys were in Camp Baka in the same prison. They were all let out. And then lo and behold, they eventually set up ISIS in Iraq, and then they went into Syria. Now, when Ahmed al-Sharaa went to Syria, just after the Arab Spring started in Syria, what happened was he had a bit of a falling out with the leadership of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. What happened was is the leader of Al-Qaeda, Baghdadi in Iraq, he wanted to unify the Syrian operation and the Iraqi operation. Ahmed al-Sharaa didn't want to do that. So this led to a falling out between them. And then eventually Ahmed al-Sharaa, he gave loyalty to the leader of Al-Qaeda globally, Ayman al-Zawahiri. And this basically led to a divide between the two groups, the effectively Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Al-Qaeda in Syria. Al-Qaeda in Syria eventually became Jabhat al-Nusra, whose leader was Abu Muhammad Jilani. And then eventually Jabhat al-Nusra became Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is a coalition of different groups. And Abu Muhammad Jilani changed to Ahmed al-Sharaa as we know him today. So that's basically his background. And what Ahmed al-Sharaa did with Hayat Tahrir al-Sham is they effectively ruled over the northern areas of Syria, Aleppo. So now that he's in power, he's had some experience with ruling, because he was ruling over the northern areas of Syria. So now obviously he's khaki uniform's gone, and now the three-piece suits have come out. And this is Ahmed al-Sharaa. He's a bit of a rock star at the moment. The world can't seem to get enough of him. So yeah, that's really his background. So he's chopped and changed quite a lot.
Yeah, he's, based on my own understanding, he seems to want to climb that political ladder. And I think, you know, he's made it to a certain extent as well. But how would you assess his performance over the last year, you know, as Syria's new leader? What do you think are his major successes? And has he had any failures, would you say, over the last year?
So it's only been 1 year, so that's quite a short time to really assess him. However, you know, he's had a difficult hand. You know, he's taken over a country that's fractured, 13 years of civil war. You've had some sectarian issues as well. The economy, the industry is completely decimated. So, you know, he's starting from a very, very weak position. So what he's been trying to do is, because the economy is decimated, he's been trying to look for foreign investment. He's been working to try and get the sanctions removed, which has been going on. So America's removed the bounty on his head. America's removed the sanctions on Syria. The UN not so long ago removed its sanctions as well. And even the EU, the sanctions they had put on Syria, a lot of them have been removed as well. Most famously, he visited the White House with a former jihadi, former Al-Qaeda member, was sitting in the White House. Donald Trump praised him, said, you know, he's had quite an interesting life. He recently visited Moscow as well. So Russia, who supported the Bashar al-Assad regime, carried out untold massacres. He's gone there as well. Probably his biggest challenge is in April 2025, there was a sectarian massacre in the minority areas. And I'm sure we're going to talk about that. But that's being used as a stick really against him, that you guys got to deal with this, you got to come down upon the people that did it, even though those people end up being from inside his regime as well. So it's only been 1 year. Ahmed al-Shara is promising the world. He's showing the people that, look, I can go to the capitals of Western countries and, you know, I can negotiate with them. But it's only 1 year. There's a long time to go. I will say 2026, if he doesn't start improving things, I think trouble's going to start brewing for him.
Okay. So to what extent does Ahmed al-Shara exercise genuine authority nationwide in Syria? You know, is his control substantive or is it fragmented among different actors?
So, you know, you're right. Your implicit question is, does he really have authority? He doesn't really. Ahmed al-Shara really is one warlord amongst many in the country. In the north, the Kurds control that particular area. In the coastal areas, you've got the Alawis, they control that area. In the south, you've got the Druze. Ahmed al-Shara is really one warlord amongst many. However, the advantage he's got is the US is trying to strengthen his rule. What the US are trying to do is show that he's a legitimate ruler. We are backing him. He's come to Washington. He's been treated well. He wasn't treated like Zelensky was when he went over. So, you know, really, Ahmed al-Shara is still trying to gain authority over the country. So I would say, look, he's one warlord amongst many. And this can change any time. The Kurds could drive me to Damascus, overthrow him. The Alawis, if they got organized and got the militia from Iraq, they could overthrow him. The Druze, with help from Israel, they could probably overthrow him as well. So his rule is still quite rocky at the moment, despite the pictures we're seeing from Syria, where he seems strong, but he's really one warlord amongst many still.
And how about his progression towards rebuilding functional state institutions? Or is it still, you know, militias and local power brokers who still dominate governance on the ground?
So effectively, what's happened in Syria is this militia, HTS, they're now in power. So they're transitioning. So like the Taliban in Afghanistan, they fought America for 20 years. Now they've got to transition to power. So what you find is all the guys that were around him, they're the guys that have gone on to take key positions within his regime. So obviously Bashar al-Assad, he had stocked the institutions and the governance with all his loyalists. And Ahmed al-Shara, he's done the same as well. The problem here is, and what he's facing, is there's still a lot of militias and factions that are not within the state structure and they can undermine him. So the Kurds have got a large force. They effectively control the northern areas of Syria. They control the energy and resource-rich areas. And they're not under his authority. So, you know, Ahmed al-Shara is still trying to unify the different factions and get them to accept that he's a legitimate ruler. So, you know, until he doesn't do this, building institutions can all be undermined. Building a functioning nation can all be undermined. And that's really the challenge he's facing currently.
Moving away from the Syrian leader and more about the Syrian people, what is the prevailing public sentiment towards the new government in the first year? You know, is there any indications to suggest rising optimism? Has confidence declined, or is something a bit more nuanced?
So the Syrian people are just happy that the security state is gone, that oppression has gone. You know, the al-Assad regime was oppressive anyway. And then when the Arab Spring started, you know, they went into fifth gear. So the people are just happy that they're not being monitored. You know, they can operate freely and they're not being massacred, they're not being killed, and they're not in a state of civil war. And, you know, that's understandable. You know, Ahmed al-Shara, he's promising the world, but 1 year, you know, nobody expects in 1 year he's going to deliver. So he's got support because the people saw it as he, you know, drove to Damascus and they overthrew the regime. So he's got that honeymoon period, really, for the moment. In fact, I would say, you know, Ahmed al-Shara's got this aura around him. You know, he and his group, they were the ones that overthrew this brutal regime. So for the moment, you know, public opinion is on his side. You know, majority of people were Sunni, they were oppressed. Obviously, there's some tension between the Druze, there's some tension with the Alawis. Overall, he's still got support, but it's only been 1 year. And people are just happy that things are not bad. So at the moment, he's not being accounted on, are you delivering? Are you making my life better? Is the economy growing? Are there jobs? He's only accounted on, he's not like Bashar al-Assad. But that will change really in the next year or two. So yes, he's got the public opinion on his side. But as time goes on, people are going to want more. they're going to want him to deliver, and that's potentially where he may face some challenges.
One of the most interesting things that I've read in the last couple of weeks is Ahmed al-Shara. We know how many individuals he has essentially rescued from these dungeons and these prisons of the Assad family. But they are still individuals from certain political parties that are still essentially locked up, that he's not released. And they are from political certain political groups which could potentially undermine himself and the Syrian government. Has that been kind of been picked up by the people, or has that been essentially been thrown under the carpet?
So what Ahmed al-Shara has done is what every ruler or revolutionary leader does when they come into power. When they come into power, one of the first things they do is who are going to be their challenges, who are going to be a problem, and you deal with them. So you may end up arresting them, or you may end up getting your senior guys to go and meet them to make sure they're not really a problem for you. So the Alawis, you know, they've completely lost power. Al-Assad, who was an Alawi, his father was an Alawi, effectively they were in power. And the military, the state institutions, and just the national politics, they've completely lost power. So that's why there's been tension really between them. In fact, the Alawis are still deciding what they're going to do. They can see America's backing this guy, so they've got to think about this, you know, what they're going to do. But they're obviously not happy. So what it seems Ahmed al-Shara has done is some of these people are still being held in prisons. Some of these people are still technically under investigation. Look, the Syrian people do want something done to people who were the eyes and the ears of the old regime. So they want them to be held accountable. They potentially want a trial. They go to prison. However, the people just seem to be happy that the old regime is gone. They're just happy with that for the moment. So to maintain his own rule, what Ahmed al-Shara is doing, and to bring everyone done this, you know, you come to power, who are your enemies? Who are going to be a problem? You've got to deal with them. So he's done the same thing as well.
And in terms of state continuity, how much of the former regime's administrative and security apparatus, you know, how many of them remain in place beneath the surface and in the background? Has there been a genuine systematic change, or has it mainly been a change in leadership and face, essentially?
No, there's been a complete clear out. The state, the Alawis, and all the supports have gone. The institution and the military have been completely changed. So in that sense, there's been a revolution. It's not just a change of face. However, you know, the Alawis still remain. They're a minority, and they are worried of their situation, what's going to happen to them. And the regime is worried, you know, what will they do with them as well. Obviously, look, the Alawis are not happy that they're no longer in power. So this is still playing out at the moment. It's only been a year. So you had this sectarian situation in May of this year. There were massacres carried out. There's still a lot we don't know about that. But, you know, that's still going to really pay out as well. But in one way, there has been a change in system. However, it's only 1 year. This still has to play out. So it's possible in 2-3 years' time, we will say there's not been a change in system. Al-Shara just continued with everything that was there before. Or out with the old, in with the new. You know, things have drastically changed in the country. So this is still really playing out.
Okay. I mean, you mentioned the Alawis quite a bit, essentially being the former regime loyalist. But how about the other militia leaders, other local power brokers and power centers? How have they responded to the new political order? Are they integrating into it? Are they negotiating with Shara? Or are they essentially quietly resisting it?
So you've got three factions in Syria. The fourth one being Ahmed al-Shara and the Sunnis. You've got the Kurds in the north. You've got the Alawis in the coastal areas. And in the south of Syria, you've got the Druze. So if we begin with the Kurds were hoping that they would get autonomy for the north of Syria. So the Kurds worked with America. America has a base in the north of Syria, or it did have for a long time. And the Kurds were used to deal with ISIS when they came into Syria. So there's about 10,000 ISIS members, children, or wives of ISIS members. They're in prisons in the northern area that the Kurds manage. So the Kurds were hoping they will get autonomy and somehow they would, you know, unite with the Kurds in Iraq. However, America has forced them to join the government. So their militia forces now, it's very likely that they will join the army of the new Syrian regime. You've got the Alawis in the coastal areas. they are for the moment still biding their time. What's going on with them is they've accepted what's happened. They're obviously not happy. However, with the regime gone, they don't have a say over the whole country. You know, they were the eyes and the ears of the regime. They took up key positions in the military, the secret services. That's not the case anymore. So they're still trying to decide what they're going to do. And probably the faction that's got the most media coverage this year is the Druze in the south of the country. So what the Druze have done is they've joined up with Israel. The Israelis saw an opportunity that they can expand into Syria, and they're working with the Druze. So one of their leaders, Hikmet Al-Hiri, he is basically in bed with Israel. So this is a problem for the regime. They've been trying to undermine Ahmad al-Sharr's regime. And they would hope that effectively the Druze get semi-autonomy and even potentially their own country in the long run. So you've got Ahmad al-Sharr in America, they want to unify Syria. Then you've got all these minorities and Israel who'd prefer Syria dissolves, because if it dissolves, Israel and these minorities will get more power. But at the moment, what America is telling these individual factions is we want to unify Syria and you've got to join the regime. Obviously, if they join the regime, they're going to be playing secondary. They're going to be just secondary, really, when it comes to the regime. So this is really played out already, and it's still going to play out going forward.
I mean, I think it's a perfect segue, because I want to talk now about Israel. Many analysts, many observers, they argue that, you know, it's emerged as a strategic beneficiary of Assad's collapse. What are Israel's current objectives and activities within Syria?
So for Israel, she faces a unique opportunity. She has a border with Syria. Syria was apparently an enemy, although behind a closed door, they are less of the regime and Israel used to always be talking. So for her, this is an opportunity to expand. You know, Israel always talks about security, and her security would only be maintained if she expands and take over more territory. So when the regime fell, within the first few days, Israel carried out a bombing campaign and just decimated all the heavy weapons of Syria. So this is one of the reasons why Ahmad al-Sharr emerged quite weak, because all that military capability has gone down the drain. They didn't secure the airfields or the bases. So what Israel's done is taken over the Golan Heights, it's taken over some of the south of Syria, and it's made clear that our agreements with the previous regime, they're gone now. So all the agreements are ripped up and we're taking over all this territory. So they've expanded into the south of Syria. They even bombed live the Ministry of Defense building and the presidential palace during the last year as well. So Israel's really showing Syria that we're going to do what we want and there's nothing you can do. And actually, there is nothing much the regime can do. So what Israel, what America's done is forced Israel to talk to the regime in Syria and to come to an agreement on how they're going to work. And what Israel's saying is we want the whole south of Syria demilitarized. There should be no military weapons there. There should be no bases there. And effectively, Israel will work with the Druze to manage that. So really, that sounds like occupation and expansion. So now America's announced it will be establishing its own base in the south of Damascus. And this is probably to monitor Israel. So for Israel, look, this is an opportunity of a lifetime. Israel can expand. There's nothing much Syria can do. And Israel wants to take full advantage of that.
You know, before going into the US and Syria relationship, I just want to kind of, the question I want to ask is, why can't Ahmad al-Sharr and Syria fight back against Israel? You know, I remember when the revolution took place. It was a Sunday morning, 3 o'clock in the morning. I stayed up, you know, refreshing my Twitter feed, X feed. And once the news came out, it was jubilation. But I remember many people, many of my friends, many of even my colleagues, they mention that why is Ahmad al-Sharr stopping at Damascus? Why does he not continue and go into Israel? Why is he unable to do? I mean, if he is able to dethrone a family that was in power for 50 years, why is he not able to go on and, you know, even take over the Golan Heights, for argument's sake?
So Ahmad al-Sharr's agenda was only in Syria. It was to overthrow the regime and take over. And he's done that. The agenda was never expansion or Syria expanding into other territory. The other thing is they don't have the capabilities. This is a militia group who fought the regime, who had been at war for 13 years, so they were drained of their resources. Ahmad al-Sharr doesn't have an air force. He doesn't have a navy. He doesn't have heavy weapons. He doesn't have missiles. So how will he take on Israel? He literally has no capability. His group has no capability. So as a result, he's having to negotiate with Israel now, and Israel's in the dominant position. So what Israel does is it says, here's our terms, and there's actually nothing Ahmad al-Sharr can do. So even with the Druze, Ahmad al-Sharr sent his forces to go and deal with them, and Israel came and bombed them, and there's nothing they can do. So Ahmad al-Sharr's hope is by working with America, America will help Ahmad al-Sharr and his regime. So effectively, America's supporting both sides. America supports Ahmad al-Sharr, and we all know about the American-Israeli relationship. So America's basically supporting both sides. So that's the situation Ahmad al-Sharr is in. Now, there is another party that he could turn to, which could make a difference, which is Turkey. But he doesn't seem to have done that. Turkey,
Before you go into Turkey, I just want to pick your brains on the US and Syria relationship, if I can. Are we seeing massive re-engagement? Because of what's happening in Gaza, for example, is it going to be some kind of distancing or conditional reassessment? It feels like America's like playing a game of chess, essentially, and Syria's one of the pawns.
So Ahmad al-Sharr and his regime haven't said anything about Gaza. They are too busy dealing with Syria. He was dealt a weak hand, so he has very little options. So all his thinking is, how can I move forward with very little resources? That's why he goes to Moscow. That's why he went to the US, and that's why he wants sanctions removed. He's trying to talk to Israel, but Israel, you know, it agrees and then it bombs him. It agrees and then it bombs another area. There's basically nothing much he can really do. So, you know, he's stuck really from that perspective.
And moving back to Turkey, essentially it was Erdogan who gave him the green light to go out and conquer the rest of Syria. Since then, what role has Turkey been playing in Syria's political and security landscape? And how has Ankara essentially recalibrated its strategy since Ahmad al-Sharr has come to the fold?
From about 2015 onwards, HTS ruled over Aleppo and the northern areas. And that was under the guidance and support and help and aid of Turkey. So Turkey is very familiar with Ahmad al-Sharr. They know each other very, very well. And Turkey played a central role, really, in arming them when they drove down to Damascus and overthrew the regime. So effectively, the south of Syria is managed and influenced by Israel, and the north of Syria is managed and effectively controlled, you could say, by Turkey. So this is why Israel is not very happy with Turkey's role. Israel would prefer that Syria dissolves into multiple little territories, because then that would allow Israel to control them. So it's not happy with Turkey's role. Turkey's role effectively counters Israel's role. However, we've got to keep in mind that there's nothing Turkey has done in Syria that goes against the US agenda. You know, I mentioned before, Ahmad al-Sharr is from Camp Bakr. America knows about him. America groomed him. He was ruling over the northern areas with Turkish help. America had no problem with that. America was the one that managed the southern groups, who then did the communication with the groups in the north when they overthrew the regime. So Turkey's not doing anything here that goes against America. What Turkey's done is actually strengthen the American agenda, strengthen the American plan. Now, Turkey does have issue with the Kurds. Turkey would prefer the Kurds were not autonomous. Turkey would prefer that the Kurds in the north of Syria don't become powerful. So for Turkey, the integration of the Kurds into Ahmad al-Sharr's regime is the best way to deal with them. And that is the American plan. That is what America wants. That is what America is pushing the Kurds to actually do. So Turkey is doing what it's always done. It gets involved in regional issues, and these issues end up helping the other powers.
What would you say in terms of Iran's influence in Syria? We know how involved they were with Bashar al-Assad, but in the last year or so, things have massively changed. What's Iran's position in everything?
Iran was the biggest loser with the fall of the al-Assad regime. you've got to keep in mind, they spent 13 years defending the regime. They embedded themselves in the country. And then in 2 weeks, the rebels marched from Damascus, and there's nothing Iran could do. In fact, Iran very quickly started to move its forces out of Syria when it became clear what was going on. So Iran even withdrew its military commanders and personnel, including its top generals that were in the country. So after all that time, you know, the top two generals of Iran's Quds forces, they were just advised to basically just leave. And they fled in the end to Iraq. So Iran did all the heavy lifting to prop up the regime. And in the end, there's nothing they could really do to help the regime. So Iran's been the biggest loser. Iran was actually setting up bases. It was embedding itself in Syria. Its plan was to stay there for the foreseeable future, save the regime, and then you could stay there. However, after October 7th, so they lost a year ago, they lost Syria. Then it got even worse because the situation of Hezbollah, they've been decimated in Lebanon. Hamas has been devastated as well. And then now Israel's had direct war with Iran as well. So really, Syria now has fallen in importance for Iran. And al-Sharaa, funny enough, is actually saying he wants to visit Tehran and he wants to develop new relations. He wants to have good relations with everybody. But Iran's, yeah, they've been the biggest loser. They've completely lost Syria. You know, 13 years, they would have fought. They've saved the regime. They've got this country. In 2 weeks, that got turned upside down.
How about another former ally, if you want to call it, Russia? You know, it's, as you mentioned, Ahmed Sharaa has visited Russia. How would you describe their strategic aims in Syria?
Yeah, so Russia supported the al-Assad regime. It intervened in 2015 when Bashar al-Assad was saying he's given up the north of the country, but he doesn't have the forces really to defend the whole country. So Russia intervened. It provided air support to the Syrian forces who were defending Aleppo and Hama. But eventually these fell very, very quickly to rebel forces. So after a decade of supporting al-Assad regime, Russia was, you know, it became heavily committed to the war it was doing in Ukraine. And we've got to keep in mind, the Ukraine war will always be a million times more important than Syria was ever going to be. You know, Syria for Russia was a small to medium operation. It was easy because they mainly provided air support. So their air assets were never under attack. The reason why Syria became important for Russia was their two bases they have on the coastal areas. This is the route they use to go to Africa. If you look at Wagner and if you look at Russia, it's in Mali, it's in all of these areas. The route through Syria was how they did it. However, when the Ukraine war started, you know, they got busy with Ukraine. I mean, we're coming up to 4 years next year in the Ukraine war. But despite all of this support that they gave to the regime, the Syrian army in the end was unable to mount an effective counteroffensive. So despite Russian air power, regime forces on the ground, they capitulated when Ahmed al-Sharaa and his forces went down to Damascus. So Moscow concluded that even before Damascus fell, that preserving its military assets was more important than getting into a prolonged battle with the advancing rebels. So Russia, it relocated its forces to Libya. So after a decade of defending the al-Assad regime, Russia determined that preserving and protecting its military assets, that was more important than defending the al-Assad regime. So Russia lost despite everything it did. However, in October, Ahmed al-Sharaa, he visited Moscow and he said he wants to maintain relations with Russia and he wants to preserve whatever relationship existed from before. So this means that the two bases Russia has in Syria, Ahmed al-Sharaa is happy for Russia to continue having these. So Russia, it really reduced its presence in these two bases, but the bases they still were using. So it seems what Ahmed al-Sharaa is trying to do is he wants to keep Russia in Syria as a counterweight to what Israel's doing. So that's why, despite Moscow supporting Bashar al-Assad, despite all the massacres they carried out, Ahmed al-Sharaa now wants to keep him there in order to be a counterweight to Israel.
Finally, the last question that I want to ask you is, taking into account the last 14 years or so, how would you assess Syria's future? You know, in your view, did the revolution ultimately achieve its aim? Or has its outcome diverged, moved away from its original aspirations?
Okay, so look, the people are just happy that the former regime's gone. They can breathe, they can sleep easily, they can go out. you know, they're not being monitored. So they're just happy with that. But we have to keep in mind that foreign powers, especially the US, they propped up the previous regime despite publicly saying that they're enemies. And what they've done is they've replaced the former regime with someone else who they can work with. So in time, I believe the divergence between the sentiment of the people and the new leadership, it will become more and more clear. What people need to realize is that the former regime was a problem. And they were a big problem. But the people that supported this regime, the people that propped it up, they are the real enemy. And America, they are more than happy with the change that's occurred. You saw it when he went to Trump. And that should be a worrying sign that there's been change in leadership, but really, is this change for the interests of the country? So really, the outcome of the revolution, there's still a question mark over it. You know, I wish I could be more positive. The Syrian people went through a lot. If you look at the Arab Spring uprisings, no country has gone through what this country has gone through. I mean, in Yemen and in Libya, there's still technically a civil war going on. But, you know, the future of this country is yet to be determined. And the signs for the moment are not great with the leader they've got, because the leader, the West are happy with him, and the West would expect him to protect their interests going forward. So let's wait and see what actually happens. But yeah, for the moment, I think the people are just happy that the former regime's gone. They can breathe easily, and you know that's understandable.
Adnan, thanks for your time today. To our viewers and our listeners, if you'd like to explore the issues that we've discussed today in more detail, please visit our website, www.thegeopolity.com. That is all one word. You'll also find a wide range of analysis, articles, and deep dive pieces on many other global topics. And also keep a lookout for the deep dive that will be coming out on Syria specifically. I'm Imran. Thank you for listening.